Father and our God, we are thankful this evening to be able to gather together, to be able to see a portion of the book of Revelation which deals with a side that should cause us to fear in one sense, because it shows your judgment, it shows your hatred of sin, and yet we know we have no fear because we have the Lamb who intercedes on our behalf. We thank you that we have your word. We thank you that we have the gospel. We thank you that the Lamb provided for us through his sacrifice. We ask for your understanding tonight as we look at these passages and we begin to sort through some of the difficult pieces of this book. And we ask for wisdom and understanding what it is you would have us to know. We ask in Christ's name. Amen. So this is number 10 in our series. We finished up last time with the throne room of God and the Lamb, chapters 4 and 5. And now we're getting ready to enter into the heart of the book. Three sets of divine judgments. Notice here that it goes from chapter 6 all the way to the end of chapter 16. That's a very hefty portion of the book. Consists of three sets of divine judgment. You've got seven seals, seven trumpets, and seven bowls. Today we start with the seven seals in chapter 6. So let's do an introduction to that, and then we'll narrow in a little bit more. So following the heavenly throne room scene, we've got the seven seals. The first four seals of the seven, which we will be covering today, we're going to cover four seals, form a distinct literary unit featuring the iconic four horsemen. Everybody's heard of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, right? This will be followed, and we'll be presumably covering this in future weeks, the fifth and sixth seals. And John does an interesting thing. He takes a little interlude in chapter 7, perhaps to provide comfort regarding God's 144,000 protected people. So chapter 7 becomes a more of a parenthetic. And then he picks up with the seventh and final seal in chapter 8, verse 1, which is described as a half hour of silence in heaven that then transitions into the seven trumpet judgments. Then we start seven trumpets after that. And there's a similar pattern for these judgments. The breakdown of the four, two, and one, and the last one opening into it. And then we'll see that as we go, but just give you kind of a layout of where we're going today and in the future. Many of the images used in these seal judgments, like much of what we looked at in the rest of the book, is deeply rooted in the Old Testament. The four horsemen draws almost directly from the colored horses and chariots patrolling the earth in Zechariah. There are some distinctions there that we'll discuss. In addition, the explicit listing of sword, famine, pestilence, and wild beast is almost the exact words found in Ezekiel 14. And then there's the sevenfold covenant curses that are given in Leviticus. So there's a lot of pieces of the Old Testament that come into play as John is presenting this material. In terms of interpretation, there are a number of differences, not anybody's going to be surprised by this, between commentators on how the judgments unleashed by these seals are to be understood. And the first disagreement I'm going to deal with, I think, is one we could dispense with pretty easily, so I'll just get it out of the way. One disagreement concerns the relationship between the seals and the scroll itself. You know, I showed you the picture of the scroll last week with the seals, and typically in that time, information conveyed by a scroll would have seals, and you would break the seal, then you would open to the contents of the scroll. And so at least one commentary, Mounts, who's pretty good commentary, really, that's one I use for a lot, he contends the scroll cannot truly be opened until all seven seals are removed, making the seal judgments preliminary to the scroll's contents. So he's saying, until you break all those seals, we can't see what's in the scroll. And while I can appreciate that's how an actual scroll would have worked in the ancient world, it seems clear, and most commentators agree, that the contents of the scroll are progressively revealed and enacted as each seal is broken. We don't wait till all seven are done and then find out what they say. So, the big and more difficult disagreement that we're going to spend a good bit of time on today, just to familiarize ourselves with what's out there. I'm going to tell you what I think it says. Have no fear. But I want us to be familiar, and some of us already are familiar, with some of the other ideas that are out there. I'm not going to do this all the way through the book, but from time to time, I want to keep everybody aware and be fair to some other points of view so you can consider them. The primary disagreement among commentaries involves the historical timing of when these judgments take place. That's the big question. And I introduced four views in the very beginning of a series, and I'll just reference them briefly. There's the futurist. That's probably the most commonly held view out there in the general population, as I perceive of it. I've never taken an actual survey. But futurist interpreters teach the judgments in these seals take place in the future end time period, thousands of years after John wrote these things. They see its future to us. Who knows how far? It could be thousands of years from us. But even if it's tomorrow, because that hasn't happened yet, it's still thousands of years from John, right? Which is what gives me a problem with their view, as I'll explain later. A good number of other commentaries, the ones I use, I don't use that many futurists. I don't find them very helpful, but you know, I'm aware of them. A good number of other commentaries, most of the ones I use, in fact, that aren't preterists, they argue that the judgments in these seals describe conditions that characterize a wide period of human history. From John's day until the second coming of Christ. Now, there's a couple would be in this category. There's the historicists who see there's being some kind of a linear unfolding of events, usually encompassing in the beginning the Roman Empire, maybe continuing on even as far as to the second coming of Christ. And then there's the idealist view, which says that these things that are being described here are things that happen over and over throughout history. They're sort of cyclical, and there's no one specific thing in mind. It's just something that happens a lot over time. That's their view of these judges. No, they're not looking for an event. I believe, so here's where I'm coming from, that's the other views. I believe it's best to understand these judgments as having taken place near, and I give references there because we've covered this before, near the time in which John wrote these things. Because John himself tells us that God gave him this revelation, quote, to show his servants the things that must soon take place. So when I go to place the events being described, I'm looking for something that's could be just thought of as soon. I don't put thousands of years in that category myself. I don't know too many people who would, right? So that kind of eliminates the first one. And even the others, I don't think they quite hit the mark. Furthermore, and this is very significant in relation to the seals, I believe the judgments associated with these seven seals, we're going to look at just four of them today, but right now we're doing an overview. I believe the judgments associated with the seven seals in Revelation 6 are the same judgments Jesus prophesied in a sermon given just prior to his crucifixion known as the Olivet Discourse. We've covered the sermon from time to time. I covered it in Daniel chapter 12. I covered it a little earlier in Daniel. I think I covered it in Isaiah series. It's a sermon that pops up often, and it's very significant in future things. And I think it's very significant in relation to what we're covering today. We find the sermon of Jesus, the Olivet Discourse, recorded in all three of what's known as the Synoptic Gospels. That's Matthew, Mark, and Luke, not John. And in that sermon, Jesus prophesies a number of future events. I'm not going to read the whole thing to you tonight, although I'm weighing devoting a class to it in the near future, but that's for another day. Jesus prophesies a number of future events, including a series of events which he tells his audience would occur before the generation of those standing there, which would have been in 30 AD or so, had passed away. So whatever it is he says is going to happen, it's got to be within a generation. How long is a generation? Some say 20 years, some say 40 years-ish. Not thousands of years, though. That wouldn't work.
Wouldn't 40 be the normal way?
I think 40 would be the norm. Specifically, Jesus prophesied that within the lifetime of those standing there, we can put it that way, because I think that's the idea. He specifically says the Roman armies would lay siege to the city of Jerusalem, because they're sitting there admiring a temple. Hey, Jesus, see the temple? Hey, yeah. Well, let me tell you something about the temple. Someday the Roman army is going to come in here, and you need to get out of Dodge. Remember all that? That's what I covered in Daniel. That's Luke 21. And the Roman army would eventually tear down the temple complex to such an extent that it says in Matthew 24, there will not be left one stone upon another that's not thrown down. And that was before that was even a glint in anybody's eye that that was going to happen, but it was coming. Now, we now know, looking back historically, these judgments, the destruction of Jerusalem and the siege of the city, came upon Jerusalem in AD 70, which is within the lifetime of those hearing Jesus' prophecy about these judgments in the Olivet Discourse, 30 AD, so that puts Jesus on the right time track. And also, those judgments would be near the time that John predicted these judgments in the book of Revelation. At least as I understand the writing of the book, I see the writing of Revelation being between 65 and 66-ish. And so 70 would be soon. 70 would be near. And he told his writers that these things must soon take place. So if he's writing about the same things that Jesus is talking about, that would put him in the same ballpark time-wise. So that's one reason why I connect the two. There's another reason why I connect the two, and that is the content of the material. I am indebted to Kenneth Gentry, who put together a chart, which he actually got from somebody else. I've cleaned the chart up a little bit, but just to make it easier to understand. So if we make two columns, we've got the six seals of Revelation, and keep in mind we haven't covered them yet, but I'm going to give you just sort of titles as to what the content of each of the seals is. We'll dig into them in more detail a little later in the class, at least the first four. And then we have over here citations from the Olivet Discourse, Jesus' sermon that he gave, what would happen within a generation. These things, as I read it, should happen soon. The six seals. Seal number one, we could just summarize as war. And Jesus says, you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. So that matches. Seal number two, you could summarize as violent conflict, a loss of peace. I think a fair equation on the Olivet Discourse side would be nation will rise against nation. Seal number three is famine. Jesus says there will be famines. Seal number four is pestilence, diseases of various sorts. And Jesus said there will also be plagues and terror. So those are a match as I see it. Seal number five is persecution. And Jesus says they will deliver you up to tribulation and put you to death, and you'll be hated by all nations for my name's sake. I would see a connection there. Seal number six is particularly interesting. It's a little more detailed and involved. And I just quoted portions of it here. Seal number six says things like, I looked and behold, there was a great earthquake. Well, in the Olivet Discourse, Jesus said there will be earthquakes in various places. Seal number six goes on and says, the sun became as black as sackcloth, the full moon became like blood, and the stars of the sky fell to the earth. Jesus in the Olivet Discourse says, there will be signs in the sun, moon, and stars. I would see those as being compatible. The sixth seal also says, everyone, slave and free, hid themselves in the caves and calling to the mountains and rocks, fall on us and hide us from the wrath of the Lamb. Jesus mentions in the Olivet Discourse that people would be fainting with fear of what is coming on in the world. So I could see those two big. So because of the similarity, the very remarkably similar similarity of these two, of the content of these two lists of judgment, and because of the overlapping time frame seeming to be right in the ballpark of what you would expect, I connect these two and say, I think it's talking about the same thing. I think so. I think so. We'll get into it next week. I haven't covered that yet, and I haven't. So, but yeah. What we are going to cover is the four horsemen, which is the first four seals, and that will, and we'll do this as we go through, you know, seal by seal, as it were. So, the opening of the first four seals in Revelation introduces the famous and sobering image of what we've already told you: the four horsemen of the apocalypse. These seals are brought forth sequentially as the Lamb breaks each seal These figures represent the unfolding of history under God's sovereign control. The seals are describing historical events that take place sometime in history. And each sequence for each seal is initiated by the Lamb breaking the seal, each of which prompts one of the four living creatures to thunderously command the rider described in that seal, come. We're going to see that when we read the actual text in detail. As I pointed out earlier, these images bring to mind Zechariah 1 and 6, where colored horses are sent to patrol the earth. I've already made that connection. However, there is some variation in how the symbols are used, just so you know. Zechariah's patrols simply report on the state of the nations, whereas the horsemen in Revelation actively seem to execute judgment. So there's not a parallel all the way down the line. The colors mostly match. I think there's red, black, and white match, and one is dappled and the other's greenish or something like that. There's a little bit of variation in the color, but mostly they match, four horsemen and all that. While the commentaries share a common understanding of the passage's overall gravity, they differ significantly over such things as the identities of the riders, the historical timing especially, and in the specific nature of the judgments. They vary over the map depending on their perspective. So with that as background, and we're going to delve into that in more detail, let me go ahead and do like we always do and read the text in the NIV that we're going to cover today, the Four Horsemen, chapter 6, 1 through 8. I watched as the Lamb opened the first of the seven seals, and then I heard one of the four living creatures say in a voice like thunder, come! I looked, and there before me was a white horse. Its rider held a bow. He was given a crown, and he rode out as a conqueror bent on conquest. When the Lamb opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, come. And then another horse came out, a fiery red one. Its rider was given power to take peace from the earth and to make men slay each other. To him was given a large sword. When the Lamb opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, come. I looked, and there before me was a black horse. Its rider was holding a pair of scales in his hand. Then I heard what sounded like a voice among the four living creatures saying, a quart of wheat for a day's wages and three quarts of barley for a day's wages. And do not damage the oil and the wine. When the Lamb opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, come. I looked, and there before me was a pale horse. Its rider was named Death, and Hades was following close behind him. They were given power over the fourth of the earth to kill by sword, famine, and plague, and by wild beast of the earth. So there's their text. There's our artist rendition of the, if you want to look at that, the four horsemen. You got the white horse and the red and the black, and then the sort of the pale or kind of greenish colored horse. So let's get into the details now. ESV, verse 1 and 2. Now I watched when the Lamb opened one of the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures say with a voice like thunder, come. I looked, and behold, a white horse, and its rider had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he came out conquering and to conquer. So the identity of the first rider on the white horse, carrying a bow, wearing a crown, and by the way, this is the Stephanos crown, which is the crown, the wreath given in, to athletes that were victorious, not the diadem crown for what it's worth, which actually the artist depicted that in the, I don't know if you noticed that. Anyways, the identity of the first rider is one of the most heavily disputed aspects of this section. The commentaries fall into two primary camps as to who this figure represents. Who is this figure on the white horse? You might guess who it might be. One group says Jesus Christ and or his gospel. Another group says military conquest or war. Some include the idea of an antichrist war figure in there, a negative figure, in other words. So let's look at each of these. Jesus Christ or the gospel. Schreiner, who's a reputable commentary, I don't always agree with him, but he's good, and many other older interpreters argue that the white horse represents Christ and the victorious spread of the gospel. This view is supported by the explicit identification of Jesus on a white horse in Revelation 19:11. So if you go all the way to chapter 19, you do see Jesus riding on a white horse. That's clearly Jesus at that point. Then say, well, it's the same person, white horse, person riding on a white horse. And then the consistently positive association of the color white throughout the book of Revelation. Everything we've seen of white so far usually represents holding the white robes and so forth. So that's their argument that it's Jesus. In this view, the phrase describing this rider as conquering and to conquer, like that hymn that I played for you before class that by Fannie J. Crosby, is taking his text in that direction, emphasized the unstoppable global triumph of the gospel message despite worldly opposition. That's what they see as represented by this white horse. Well, what do we think? Well, I would say while these things are true about Jesus and the triumph of the gospel, and I can sing a hymn just fine, you know, it doesn't bother me, even though I think maybe there was a misunderstanding of this particular passage. I do think the concept is true. I do not believe the idea fits well with the other three horsemen, all of which bring suffering, death, and destruction. So you got four horsemen. Definitely the last three seem negative and problematic. And you got a first one that's real positive. I mean, I suppose that's possible. It's kind of like these, I used the illustration this morning, but these IQ tests where they show you four things and say, which one's not like the others, right? You know, the white horse? Yeah, I don't know. I would see the horses as all being negative. And so I just tend not to go that direction. I can't say absolutely it's wrong, but that would not be my inclination. I would be inclined to see it as military conquest or war. Carson, Beale, and many modern commentators interpret the white horse as militarism and aggressive imperial conquest. So that's where I would be. But then the question becomes, historically, what specific imperial conquest is in view? So once you get past the first question, is it Jesus or is it like a negative warlike conquest? If you say, well, let's agree it's warlike conquest, which warlike conquest? Right? You still got that question to answer. So I'm going to do this all the way through these four horsemen, give you a summary of the main perspective on each horseman, just brief summary. So the futurists, the guys that believe in some future judgment out there, future to us, thousands of years future to John, they believe this is talking about the rise of the future Antichrist, who initially conquers through diplomacy, deception, or political power during the tribulation. So they see this as conquest of the Antichrist in some way, maybe includes military eventually. The historicists tends, and again, there's variations on each of these views, so I'm sort of blanketing them together. The early military victories and expansion of the Roman Empire, especially during the period of the greatest strength of conquest. They see this as an unfolding of linear history. That's where they would go with it. The idealist sees that this is referring to the recurring human drive toward conquest and domination throughout history. It's just something that's cyclical. It happens over and over and over and over, and it's just talking about that thing, that no specific event particularly, just a principle that we see repeatedly throughout history. Where do I land? I believe the best way to understand this passage is the preterist view, as explained by Kenneth Gentry. I found him to be the most persuasive and most helpful on this particular section, so I cite him and footnote him. I see the white horse as representing war, specifically the military developments leading to Jerusalem's destruction in 70 AD. So yes, it's military, it's war. It's a specific war, the war that was waged against Israel by Rome. The horseman launches a series of judgments that will eventually bring devastation upon Israel, the destruction of the temple and the murder and death of most of the people in the city. Taking the imagery in this way fits well with Jesus' Olivet Discourse, where wars and military upheavals are among the signs preceding Jerusalem's fall. And I didn't give you the whole passage, but I gave you a lot of citations that pointed in that direction. So that's where I land on the first rider. Verse 3 and 4, we come to our second seal. When he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, come, and out came another horse, bright red. Its rider was permitted to take peace from the earth so that people should slay one another, and he was given a great sword. Second horse is bright red, it says. The rider is given power to take peace from the earth so people may slaughter one another. A great sword, that's the Makarios, the two-edged sword, is given to him. Virtually all commentaries agree this horse symbolizes violent conflict. So we get a lot of agreement on that part. The red color naturally suggests bloodshed. So that goes with the first idea. The rider removes peace, unleashes widespread violence. Some distinguish this rider from the first, because remember, the first rider is war, and they're thinking, well, what's the difference between this and the first horse, right? By seeing the first horse as organized conquest by an army defeating in war, and the second horse represents civil unrest, revolution, or social breakdown within the society itself. Both involve destruction, both are associated with war, but there's a nuanced difference in the two, as many would see it, and I would agree with that. Carson especially emphasizes this distinction. The first rider represents conquering armies, while the second represents people turning on one another in violent internal conflict. But again, the question becomes, historically, when did this widespread violence, if that's what it is, and civil unrest, when did that occur? Which one of those is that? Because there's been lots of widespread violence and civil unrest. We have it in our day. Below is a summary of three main perspectives. This is going to get repetitive after a while. You're going to start there. I see where this is going. That's okay. That's the design of why I'm presenting it the way I am. The futurists. Widespread warfare that breaks out during the future tribulation after the Antichrist's initial rise. The historicists might say the civil wars and revolts and internal bloodshed that weakened the Roman Empire during its early expansion. The idealists will say the continual reality of war, violence, bloodshed that affects humanity in every age. This is something that happens over and over. I see the judgments that accompany this seal fulfilled in the social and political chaos that accompanied the Roman siege of Jerusalem in 70 AD. When you read the historical accounts of Josephus, a Jewish historian who wrote of that event in a significant amount of detail, you see that the suffering and devastation that occurred during the Roman siege of Jerusalem was the result of more than just Roman aggression. It was the result of a great deal, in fact, of Roman aggression. Jerusalem was torn apart by factional violence, civil strife, and internal bloodshed before the city finally fell. The city was surrounded, they were running short on food, tempers were running high, and internal groups started conflicting and killing each other. There was death taking place in the city before the Romans ever even moved on it. That would be the second horse. The second seal intensifies the first. Conquest from without is accompanied by collapse from within. And that's not atypical of a city that's under siege. That could very commonly happen. When he opened the third seal, I heard the living creature say, "Come." I looked and behold a black horse, and its rider had a pair of scales in his hand, and I heard what seemed to be a voice in the midst of the four living creatures say, "A quart of wheat for a denarius, 3 quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine." So the third rider sits on a black horse, has a pair of scales in his hand, and there's a voice that says, you know, this statement about denarius and quart of wheat, 3 quarts of barley, and then don't harm the oil and wine. What is that all about? Well, the scales, I think, symbolize rationing and scarcity. A denarius was a day's wage. That's how much money somebody could earn in a day, whatever that is today. I don't know, depending on who you are, what you earn in a day, I suppose. But it was a significant amount of money, and yet it only purchased a rather small amount of grain, maybe enough for your day's meal. So if you got to work all day just to eat a meal for yourself, how are you going to feed your family, for example? Clearly, famine and severe economic hardship are in view. That seems to be the consensus, and I would agree with that. Food prices have become many times higher than normal, making survival difficult. And then there's this odd phrase, "Do not harm the oil and the wine." And there's a couple ways that gets interpreted. Some see it as evidence that the wealthy continue to enjoy luxuries while the poor suffer. Others view it as there's just a limitation on judgment, showing God's wrath is severe in terms of what they can eat in terms of the wheat and barley, but it's not all pervasive yet. And that is very common. Carson favors this idea. It's significant, but not total. Worse judgments remain to come. And we see that quite a bit in these judgments. So that seems reasonable, I think. Again, here's the question. When did this severe economic hardship occur? There's lots of economic hardship in the history of man. Which economic hardship are we talking about here? Well, that was a summary of the perspectives on this. When do you think the future sees it happening? you guys got this down yet? Severe famine and economic collapse during the future tribulations, often viewed as a consequence of war. Maybe the Antichrist is in there somewhere. What about the historicists? Economic hardship, scarcity, oppressive taxation, and famine experienced during the various stages of Roman decline. Maybe it's a part of the unfolding of history. What do you think the idealist is going to say? The recurring conditions of scarcity, poverty, famine, economic inequality. These things happen over and over in human history. It's just talking about that. And what do you think I'm going to say? 70 AD, right? I believe this is the description of the conditions that developed during the siege of Jerusalem in 70 AD. As supplies dwindled and normal commerce collapsed, food became desperate and scarce. The Romans had them surrounded. They couldn't get access to outside sources of food. The famine imagery echoes both Old Testament covenant curses and Jesus' prediction of famines in the Olivet Discourse in that event. And then regarding the command to not harm the oil and the wine, I would see this phrase as showing that God is restraining the devastation at this stage. I wouldn't necessarily see it pertaining to the rich having it and the poor not. I mean, maybe it means that, but I'm inclined to go this way. Wheat and barley are expensive, but more judgments coming. And this fits the broader pattern of Revelation where judgments increase progressively. I've already mentioned all that. Then we get to 7 and 8, the last seal that we're going to cover, which is the fourth seal, fourth horseman. When he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, "Come." And I look and behold a pale horse. And its rider's name was Death. And Hades followed him. And they were given authority over a fourth of the earth to kill with the sword, with famine, with pestilence, and by wild beasts on the earth. So the final horse is, in our translation, pale. It's a word that could be translated sickly green or green. It's actually the Greek word chloro, I think. Chloroform? Chlorophyll? Not chlorophyll. Chlorophyll. Anyways, it's a kind of a thought to be a pale or sickly green, the color of a corpse. And that's how that artist portrayed it in that picture I showed you a while ago. I think it's probably pretty accurate, at least as I see it. The rider is named Death. And then it says Hades. Hades is the word for the abode of the dead. It's where people in that day envisioned the dead go after they die. That's where their souls go or what have you. They die and then they end up in Hades. Just a poetic, elaborate way of saying they died. The writer gathers together the effects of the previous judgment because you see a lot of overlap here. War, there's death. Internal strife, there's death. Bloodshed. Economic hardship. Maybe people are even dying as a result of that. Death is said to come here through sword, famine, pestilence, and wild beasts. So specifically, these causes are identified, overlapping much with the previous writers. The fourfold killing mechanism, sword, famine, pestilence, and wild beasts, are a direct echo of Ezekiel 14:21, where God threatened Jerusalem in that day with the exact same judgment. Those very words. Where God said, if you don't obey me, this is what's going to happen. Sword, famine, pestilence, wild beast. And here they are. The Jews are suffering because they're disobeying God. They killed Jesus, for one thing. Death and Hades are not independent powers. It says authority is given them to operate only within the limits established by God. And the judgment reaches only a fourth of the earth, demonstrating God's judgment is real, but it's not comprehensive yet. Only a fourth, which is enough. Here's the big question. Historically, when was death and Hades unleashed over a fourth of the earth, so to speak, through sword, famine, pestilence, and wild beast? Here's a summary of the main views. The futurist, massive death through war, famine, disease, and other disasters during the future tribulation period. The historicist, widespread death, pestilence, and societal collapse that accompanied later deterioration of the Roman Empire, perhaps. Again, there's different views of the historians, but that's a very common one. And the idealist, death is an inevitable companion of war and disease and famine. Suffering in a fallen world through the church age continues to happen over and over cyclically. It's just one of those things that happen. It's just talking about that, nothing specific. And I'm going to say, I would see the judgments that come with the fourth seal as describing some of the horrors experienced by the Jews in Jerusalem during and immediately after the Roman siege of the city in AD 70. Famine and pestilence are known to have taken place during the siege, and you can understand why. Josephus talks about that. Wild beast is kind of interesting. You wouldn't necessarily say, where are wild beasts doing in the city? Right? You might ask that question. I don't know if they were. It could be a reference to the fact that according to Josephus, the dead during the siege piled up faster than they could be buried. They were dying in such rapid rates, and there wasn't a whole lot of place to bury them in the city. They didn't get to see it. That's one problem. And the other thing is they're dying so rapidly that they finally got to the point where they threw them over the walls into the Kidron Valley, where they were left exposed to scavengers, thus fulfilling a judgment that the Lord specifically said in Deuteronomy 28, when he gave the law, would come upon those who disobeyed him. He warned, and your dead bodies shall be food for all birds of the air and for, there it is, the exact phrase, beasts of the earth, and there shall be no one to frighten them away. A Jew would be horrified at the idea of their body just being left for the animals to eat. That was not... I know in our age, you know, we can burn it or do whatever, and if to save money, fine. And I sometimes have questions about that. I'm still trying to think about my own instructions for death, you know. It's a burial thing. It certainly was in that time. It was important to the Jews that the body be respected, even after the person was gone from the body, to be cared for and buried properly. So it was horrifying to think your body would be just thrown out there to be eaten by wild animals. That was not a pleasant thought in that day. Probably shouldn't be in ours, but we won't go there. Then it says, authority is given over a fourth of the land. Now this could, I suspect, be just judgment is not. And those land. So in our translation, it says a fourth of the earth. Why did I translate it land? Because the Greek word for land is the same as the Greek word for earth. It depends on the context. Ge can mean land, it can mean earth. Since we're talking about Jews of the land, I would be inclined to see a translation of land here as opposed to earth. There's nothing in the Greek that tells you one way or the other. You have to just go by the context. There's an interesting idea that Gentry comes up with. I don't know what there's much to this, but I cite it because it's interesting. And Gentry cites a source indicating that counting the Passover pilgrims who had flooded into Jerusalem for the feast and then found themselves trapped by the encircling Roman army, the city's population during the siege may have approached something like a quarter of the nation's total population, or a fourth or 25%. Could it be that? I don't know. I wouldn't, that wouldn't be a hill to die on for me, but I thought that was interesting. So there you go. Yes, sir.
Galilee was struck earlier.
The what?
Galilee was struck earlier.
By the Romans?
By the Romans. So the Jews in Galilee who were still able to fight and fled to south to Jerusalem.
Okay.
So there would have been an influx
of people,
a massive influx of fighters, the ones who were able to travel to Jerusalem, and at the same time the Christians were
advised to get out.
Out of Jerusalem.
Yeah, get out of Dodge, right. So there was good evidence there was a swelling of the population. I was not aware of that piece of it, but you know, this particular person that Gentry cites talks about them coming for the feast.
Josephus, I think, is a reference on that one.
Okay. Well, it was somebody named, I forget his name, I didn't put it down here, but we could look it up in the book. But anyhow. Well, there you have it. That's as far as we're going to get today. And for the discussion time, what I would like to do, I didn't even get my little clicker thing out. Let me do that real quick. That way I can stand out here and not be hiding behind my screen. So in my discussion of the six seals described in Revelation 6 through 8, I said I believe the judgments associated with those seals were the same judgments Jesus described in the Olivet Discourse, and I gave two reasons why I thought that. The judgments in each case would have occurred around the same time frame, 70 AD. It's within a generation of Jesus, and it's within soon, whatever that means, for John. And then also the descriptions of the judgments were very similar, as I showed you on that chart. and fit well with the events that occurred in the fall of Jerusalem. So they all seem to fit together. If you look at what happened in the fall of Jerusalem, you look at what Jesus said in the Olivet Discourse, where he clearly says he's talking about the fall of Jerusalem, and then you look at these seals, which don't specifically mention Jerusalem, but they match the others. I want to make that connection because of that. So I'm asking here, what do you think? Do you think I've made a good case here for these to be connected? Are the judgments, the six seals, the same judgments that Jesus was warning about when he gave the Olivet Discourse?
Thank you, sir.
What do you think?
I think it's good.
A good assessment.
Explanation text.
Anybody else have thoughts on it? You guys can always say things. I know you don't say much these days. Or Dan, Dan, Jerry, whatever.
When there's parallels, you got to at least consider that, right?
Yeah. It's not nailed down to the point of being irrefutable, but it certainly seems very strong in terms of making a connection. If you're going to connect it with something in history, you're not going to be an idealist and just say, well, these things happen. Okay. Well, let's talk about those other views. Another way of kind of framing the larger picture now, instead of just that specific connection. As I went through each of the judgments associated with the four horsemen of the apocalypse, I explained how each of these judgments would be identified historically by the four most common views taken by commentaries writing about the judgments found in the book of Revelation. I talked about the futurist view that these things take place at some future time, even to us, and occur thousands of years after the time John was writing, during some future tribulation with a future Antichrist and all that. I talked about the historicist view that these things take place over a long period of history, starting with the Roman Empire, potentially continuing until Christ's return. Depending on which one you read, how far they go with that, and how they unfold it. But they see it as a linear unfolding of events in history. The idealists, the judgments are just descriptions of things in general that happen cyclically. And then the view I took, the preterist view, that these are descriptions of judgments that will be taking place very near the time John is writing, and mostly describe events that occurred around 70 AD when the city of Jerusalem fell at the hand of the Romans. And so I ask, which of these views do you find most persuasive and why? And while you're thinking about that, I'll go ahead and throw this up here. What would you say are the strong points and weak points of each of these four views? Because even though I don't agree with all the views, I could point out things about the other views that, first of all, are weak points why I wouldn't go for them, but maybe strong points that something they have going for them in a sense, that they don't, they're not without value. What are your thoughts? Which of these views do you find most persuasive and why?
I think the historicist view is very arbitrary. Where do you divide it? How do you divide it up?
That's one of the weaknesses, yeah.
It's never satisfied me in terms of its being an answer. The futurist view is entirely speculative.
Yeah.
So that doesn't leave very much.
We've narrowed it down now. We've got the idealist. What do you think about the idealist view? These things happen. Stuff happens.
that does happen.
It does happen, right?
It still happens. We've had two world wars in the last century.
We've had economic hardship. We've had internal strife. We've had,
And if you have to connect it to the Jews, of course, the Jews suffered from the Turks and from the Nazis.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there have been many events, and there's that going for it, but at the same time, is it really saying anything? When you just say it happens all the time, well, yeah, okay, so why put that in there? People die. is that the point? Or is there a specific event coming soon that people need to be focused on and worried about and thinking about how they're going to respond? And is that the idea? It seems to me like that's what John's getting at. He's not just saying, stuff happens. That's where I see the weakness. The strength of the idealist view is that, in principle, even if these things are talking about 70 AD instead of today, we could apply principles that they applied then in our day to some degree, not completely. It's a unique event, of course, but that's where you could make application. But in terms of that's what John's saying.
Question is whether the subsequent chapters where he's given different imagery and things,
right,
you know, that all fits.
That's
where you get it.
Yeah, that's where I'm going to have to be able to make the case all the way through the book.
So I think that the preterist view, at least in regard to Jerusalem and the suffering there, was the most appropriate and efficient in handling the ideas of the text.
Yeah.
But once you leave that, you got to ask questions a lot more.
Yeah. And I do think we do get a little beyond that again.
You've got to get them army tanks in there somewhere.
What's that?
They're going to have the army tanks.
The army tanks?
Yeah.
Army tanks.
Oh, the army tanks. Yeah, and the helicopter. Don't forget the locust.
Yeah, they got to have them.
Helicopters or whatever. Yeah, yeah. That's the futurist, right? You know, I pointed this out this morning. One of the strengths, although I think really it's a weakness, of the futurist view is it's not falsifiable. You know what I mean by that? How can you ever disprove it? If I say to you, China's going to invade Taiwan within the next 5 years, okay? Well, 5 years from now, if they haven't invaded Taiwan, you could say, Bob, you were wrong. And I could say, oops, okay? But if I say to you, China's going to invade Taiwan sometime in the future, could be hundreds of years, thousands of years, 10 years, I don't know. It's just way out there somewhere. So 20 years from now, 100 years from now, if China hasn't invaded Taiwan, you come to me, if I was still around, which I wouldn't be, and say, Bob, what happened to your prediction? Well, I didn't say when. It's just out somewhere out there. It's going to happen, right? So that to me is what the futurist view does. There's Antichrist, and there's all these helicopters and tanks. And I mean, they get crazy with that stuff. And okay, how could you never disprove that? And yet it's just so widely taught. I mean, in our church, we have several people who, I was asking people these questions, and several people raised me, yeah, that's what I was, you don't believe that? You know, you don't believe in the rapture? No, I do not, as a matter of fact. You know.
Just the futurist and the idealist seem to make the text, they want it to be immediately applicable to us as the readers, not immediately applicable to the initial readers.
Yeah.
They want it to be, you know, whatever period of time you're reading it, whether the first century readers or 21st century readers or millionth century readers. It's constantly, it's always near to them.
Always near.
To us.
Just about ready to happen.
Right.
Like the always clock is almost at midnight.
Just be ready.
Yeah, be ready. Be ready. And there's a sense in which we should be ready, because the second coming of Christ is described in just that way in the Olivet Discourse. Unlike Jesus' description in the Olivet Discourse of the fall of Jerusalem, he speaks of his second coming. And of his second coming, he says, no man knows the day or the hour. It's like a thief in the night. If you knew when it was going to come, you'd be prepared. You don't know when it's coming, so always be ready. So that we need to always be ready for. But the judgments that relate to the fall of Jerusalem, he says, watch for the signs. When you see the signs coming, get out of Dodge. Because that's a specific thing you can see coming on the horizon, and there's warning before it gets there. So the Chinese get the ships in the harbor, and we get, uh-oh. So if you're going to take my analogy of earlier.
So would you think that Second Thessalonians is referring to this same event, always seeing something happen?
Yeah, I'm going to have to review that, because I read a lot of things from Gentry on that that made sense to me, that fit with this, but I need to go back and put that, because I wasn't this far into my text then, so I'm still putting that together right now. I'm going to refrain from commenting on Thessalonians, but it will be coming. I'm thinking about next week, I don't know what y'all think about this, but because I made such a big deal out of the Olivet Discourse, take a little parenthetic study. I don't want to make a multi-week thing out of it, maybe just a kind of a more of a high level, but go through all the verses of the Olivet Discourse and spell out what I think's going on there. Tell you everything Jesus says, put the synoptics together, and say, this is where I think this is, and this is, and this is. So you can kind of see, because I had a guy in our church come up to me this morning and said, I had never heard of that text before.
Paul would be very upset about that.
Yeah, because Paul actually taught it. But
our
this guy
actually taught through Matthew 24.
He did.
And how did he teach it?
He did divide it up. I don't remember, and again, I've come a long way since he taught it. I'd be a lot more specific about what I'd be looking for than I was at the time.
The pastor of our church, Paul,
Oh,
the guy, he visited our class once, I think. You may or may not remember him, but anyways, yeah, he taught through Matthew 24. I don't remember it being too far off from what I understood at the time. Because clearly there are two events at play there. You just get into when does the divide take place? When's he talking about this and when's he talking about that? Because he doesn't make it super clear. Although I think if you understand what you're looking for, it actually becomes very clear. And I would do that. If I went through that text, I would explain all that. I think I'd be ready to do that at this point. I don't know if y'all think that would be a good thing to do, but I'm thinking about doing that. It would be a little bit of diversion from my revelation, but I've already brought this text up, like I said, twice in Daniel and once in Isaiah, and here it is again. Let's just deal with the text. I don't mind doing that. I would like to do it for my own benefit. And maybe we'll throw in Thessalonians while we're at it, because I've got some things on that as well. That might be good to include. I had a guy ask me, what about the Antichrist? You know, where'd that fit in? And because we're eventually going to get into who's the beast, who's the harlot, who's the, you know, we're going to have to get into all that before we get all said and done. I can't say I have all that sorted out yet, but
all pre-70. All of these other texts are all pre-70 AD.
Right.
You know?
That's true.
And
so they could
man
be.
Of sin may or may not refer to the book.
Right.
Well, that's the question. Is it Nero or is it
some other
person?
Yeah. So, future classes, hopefully I'll get that all sorted out and unfold it. I mean, it would have been nice if I could just study the whole book of Revelation and have it all down and then start teaching through it, but I'm just teaching as I go and taking it one step at a time, look at the text, look at what was presented and thinking it through. And it seems pretty obvious so far.
You could solve all our theological problems in interpretation.
It would, yeah.
Just bring them all together.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll do something like that. One fell swoop.
Okay, I see.
I think he said one fail swoop.
One fail swoop. Maybe so.
Okay, I see a strength of the idealist view.
Okay.
Is that when you go through the book, you have what appears to be the end in chapter 6, chapter 10, chapter 15, and it seems to be a cycle.
A cycle, yeah.
It seems to be repeating. So you see this end here. And you see the end, and you see the end. So I think that's a strength of that view. I obviously think a strength is for the preterist is the AD 70 with some of these parallels. But I see the weakness of the preterist view, because I'm not there at this point. And when you say preterist, again, I have that whole problem, because you're not a preterist, but you're putting forth a preterist view. You're not a preterist.
You mean I'm a partial preterist?
Yeah.
And there's that distinction too. Yeah. And I tried to identify that early on in the series and say a full preterist is basically a heretic.
Right.
And I'm not that. So
right.
I'm shortening it down to preterist. Technically, I'm a partial preterist.
Well, maybe you could put P-preterist.
P-preterist, maybe.
Because I think the problem with the full preterist view and where it is so close to the view that you're representing, the partial preterist view, as I've been looking at a little bit more, is that when they say, as you say here, I believe it's best to understand these judgments. See, now you're putting some theological viewpoint in there.
Right.
I believe it's best to understand these judgments as having taken place near the time in which John wrote these things. But John doesn't say these things are near and then say, now these judgments are near. And which judgments? Because there's a judgment mentioned in Revelation 20, right? The Great White Throne Judgment, that some people want to say was near and is past.
Yeah.
You see? Right. So I think that's a very strong weakness, because people want to say all of it's done. And the argument could be made that, look, he even says in Revelation 22, as you point out here, Revelation 22:6, these things are near, and this is after 21,
right,
and 20, and right, 19. So that's where I think the danger of that view is, because somebody who's completely new to it could say, well, then you've got to say it's all near. And then, of course, we know that there are people who say it's all near.
Right.
And so one thing that I have generally looked at Revelation 10, where it talks about the seventh trumpet, because that is in Revelation, the last trumpet. And so then when you come to 1 Corinthians 15, it talks about the last trumpet.
Okay, yeah.
And then people will say, 1 Corinthians 15 has already passed.
Yeah.
I think Doug Gooden has come to that conclusion.
Oh, has he really?
I think so. And see, that's where I think the danger is, because he would say that, as I have listened to a little bit of him, I believe he also puts 1 Thessalonians 4 as already passed. I don't think you would do that.
I left that open for right now.
Yeah. So I'm seeing too many of these passages, like 1 Thessalonians and 1 Corinthians 15, as having already happened, and that concerns me. Because when 1 Corinthians 15 happens, death is swallowed up in victory. There is no more death.
Right.
And so if it's already happened,
yeah,
in AD 70,
something's going on.
It doesn't fit.
Yeah.
So that's where I'm.
But the seven trumpets don't have to be the same.
It doesn't have to be a reference to the same thing.
The seven trumpets could be different than the quote last trumpet.
Yeah.
They could be, but when you look at what is connected with the last trumpet in 1 Corinthians 15,
right,
you certainly get the end, you certainly get the picture,
right,
related back to Isaiah 25, that the that this is the end. Mortal puts on immortality, death is swallowed up in victory, and then when you come to the last trumpet in, or the seventh trumpet in Revelation 10, it talks about the time of the judgment of the saints and the rewarding. So that's where I can see a cyclical, you know. Anyway, I'm just
answering your
question.
Yeah, good
point. Cyclical solves that problem.
Huh?
Cyclical solves that problem. I don't understand how taking a cyclical view would solve that problem.
Because he's saying that it's kind of the Hendrickson view. You know, that it's just a cycle that goes over. It starts over at the beginning, and it starts all over again,
yeah,
and it starts over again.
1 Corinthians 15 is
not No, I would say 1 Corinthians 15 is at the end, and so when we come to Revelation 10, it's near the end, and then you pick up in 11, and then you come to 15, and it's near the end, and so that's. But I'm not settled. I'm just.
Okay, so that's a different cyclical than what Bob's talking about, the cyclical view that just says this stuff happens throughout history over and over.
Right.
You're saying that each of these vignettes is referring to the same thing in a cyclical way.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, the idealist sees not even that. It just sees things that death happens throughout history.
So I have a fourth view, a fifth view then.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I wouldn't fall in any of those in a sense.
You have to take into account here, in the first century, there wasn't a lot of knowledge about the expanse of the world as all that was involved. They had a Mediterranean, that's the population of the world, the Mediterranean, and in Britain, Britain. It's just along the coast of eastern, the western coast of Europe. But they didn't really have a broad enough view about the enormity of everything. I mean, the gospel, Paul says it's gone into all the earth.
The world.
Almost 1:8 or 9.
Colossians.
Yeah. So that's he's talking about the world, the Roman world.
Yeah.
He's not talking about down in South Africa or
North America.
North or South America. All those things are largely unknown.
Yeah.
And so he has a limited view of the world, but I'm not saying that he's inspired so that the language is going to satisfy the ultimate end, but the ultimate end has to come for the whole world.
Yeah.
And not just the Mediterranean world. And so what happens to Jerusalem was critical to their world. But we have a bigger view of this, and the 1 Corinthians 15 has got to be talking about the end of time and the exaltation of Christ over all mankind.
Yeah.
It's a majestic view of all of mankind being subjected to Christ. And Revelation, the destruction of Jerusalem is not the whole destruction that needs to take place. Rome's going to be destroyed, and all of that empire, it was still expanding in the first century. It was nowhere near finished yet.
Right. A lot of things to keep in mind, and I may have to change my label to partial preterist in case somebody...
Yeah, when it says land or it says the world,
yeah,
those terms are capable of legitimately to be understood in more microscopic or even in a much larger view.
Yeah.
Because we don't have a definition for world that doesn't include everything. Our view of the world, we got a sphere in mind, you know, 7 continents and all of that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and Gentry makes a lot of connections with, like, the tribes of the land. That's Old Testament language being picked up, and then it gets translated into tribes of the earth in the New Testament places, and he's saying, no. This is a pickup on an Old Testament idea, and they used the wrong translation for that word in that specific context. You follow what I'm saying?
In Romans?
No.
I think it's in Revelation. I forget. I've read him widely on a lot of different books.
Who?
Gentry.
Gentry. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So I have a comment and an idea. You may not like my idea. You may like it, but you may not go for it. Just like I'm done with penal substitutionary as a title.
Yeah.
It's blood sacrifice, okay?
I got you.
So why don't partial preterists just say fulfilled view? In other words, that's what you're saying, right? Because that's what the word means. It means fulfilled. So you got the futurist view, which says, hey, look forward. Preterists, you get the average Joe walking in the church building, he doesn't have a clue what preterists mean, right? It's a word that is used by people who know terminology, and it has meaning, this meaning to this person, but fulfilled. So you got the future view, you got the cyclical view, you got the fulfilled view. In other words, this took place, it's fulfilled. I mean, just from a practical standpoint, it seems like that would be a term that could avoid confusion.
It could.
Especially when you have heretics that anyone who knows the scripture would say, right?
But then again, if I start saying that the the great white throne judgment's already been fulfilled, then we got, we're back in trouble again, right?
Well, no, because you're not saying that even you are saying that the judgments
right.
are fulfilled in AD 70. You've never said that the whole book is fulfilled.
Right. There are portions of the book that go beyond that.
Yeah. Right. We agree on that. I'm just saying, for you know, we know that, you know, you get people who come into certain churches and they hear terms, they have no clue, you know.
And if they start looking into it, they can get all kinds of...
They can. Well, okay, so Bob Preterist...
Terms.
Yeah. Anyway.
You know, it's one thing to teach the theology with theological terms being used and thrown around in a context where there's people who are capable of managing
yeah.
the ideas because they have the background and knowledge. And another one from the pulpit, if you're going to have a door that's open to unbelievers coming into the congregation and hear the word of God, I'd be very careful about what you say.
Yeah, I like
trying to lose them real quick.
There's a pro and con side of that whole thing, because I like tying into standard theological language so that people become educated of the theological world and the terms that are used in that world, and then just define those terms as they're used in that world and familiarize them. So there's this term called preterist. There's a full preterist. And I explained all this in the beginning. I maybe should have given another primer on it here in this lesson.
But anytime a new person comes in, unless you give that or you put some indication, partial preterist,
yeah.
you know...
Yeah, you could do that. I mean, and that's why I would like the idea of staying with something like partial preterist, because then it ties you into a larger theological idea that's discussed elsewhere, where it's fulfilled. Yeah, it communicates the idea. We got into this in Calvinism. Some people don't like using the word Calvinism because, oh, people think that means that you want to, you know, burn Servetus at the stake, you know. No, that's a theological term that has meaning. And, well, somebody could walk in the door and not know what that means. They think you just want to burn some beaters at the stake. They might think that.
Well, you know? And I'm going to tell you my ongoing situation right now that I don't think I've mentioned it to you, but I've been in contact with a pastor in the Philippines. Did I mention that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
And my whole point that I keep driving home, he's from an Arminian region, and they hate Calvinism. And I'm like, quit using the term Calvinism. Don't use total depravity. Don't use these terms. You stick as much as possible to the biblical terms and then drive them back to the scripture, right? And so I'm still holding that ground. I mean, I understand, because then maybe after when we're just discussing, I want to share with you one of the problems with systematic theology, which I'm growing more and more to really despise because of the deadliness that it can produce. But anyway, I said you may not agree, but I'm just throwing out an idea here.
I see pros and cons. I like tying people into the larger community of ideas with cautions and explanations and all that. And if you got 5 minutes on an elevator, you probably don't want to use the term if you're going to confuse somebody. But if you have a chance to teach a class where you can define your terms and lay out the history, it helps people connect to people in history who believe many of the things that we believe. They used other terms for it, and these are terms that are used across the board in seminaries and other churches, so that you have some kind of common vocabulary to be able to speak to other people outside your narrow group where you use your own little terms, you know. I mean, that's okay.
Well, if they're biblical terms. I mean, that's the point I'm making.
Right, but sometimes, you know, like there's no biblical term for Trinity, for example. So I like to teach the idea of Trinity. Well, it's not a Bible term.
Mm-hmm.
I think the idea of Trinity is absolutely biblical. But that's a term that ties you into a whole historical context. You've got Arians today, you know, Jehovah's Witness and what have you. So I think there's value in sometimes using terms outside of Scripture. In fact, in the Trinitarian debate, they had to use terms outside of Scripture to nail the Arminians. Because if they just stuck to biblical language, they could always twist every text. And I'm just sticking to the Bible,
you know. The people who want to twist, right, and the people who want to twist will always twist. I mean, you know, the person who doesn't, you know, you can drop the term Calvinism, and if people hate that, those teachings, they're going to oppose it anyway. And that's sort of where I'm at with this guy.
Yeah.
Trying not to be inflammatory.
The primarists that are saying, and many modernists are in a functionally preterist in their idea of the resurrection. They say it's already happened.
The full preterist, yeah.
Yeah. What are we talking about? Well, you had the resurrection of the soul. New life. And, well, we don't deny there's a spiritual resurrection.
Sure.
But there's more than that.
That's correct.
And that's the part that they're not recognizing or do not choose to recognize.
Yeah.
I had a Methodist uncle who was very weak on theology. And he was a perfectionist in his own personal views, and when you talk about the spiritual resurrection, that's what they're looking for. Well, and for them, it's a whole different world, point of view of the world. Well, it's fine to have, Christians do have a different point of view of the world, but that's not enough.
Yeah.
And it's not the full story, because what started in us is going to ultimately end up in a physical resurrection. And that is absolutely biblical language. Yeah. Teaching of the Bible, you know. So you can't go full preterist. You end up denying Scripture.
Right.
So, I agree with Dan that I never would introduce those terms in a context of people who are novices and are struggling to even grasp the simple basic truths about Christianity, because they've never really given any thought or had any contact with it.
Yeah, well, and most of this is designed for our church, which I wouldn't call them novices. I mean, we have some novices, but we've got a wide range of people.
Immature.
We have those, but we have some that are. But she's wanting me to end the tape.
She's taking away.
You have more questions?
No, that's it.
Oh, that's all.
So we'll go ahead and end the tape.